From NPR West, you're listening to the podcast edition of All Things Considered, the best picks from our programs on Saturday and Sunday. I'm Kelly McEvers, in for Arun Rath. This episode, 2 months after Typhoon Haiyan in the Philippines.
There's no way to look at this and think, yeah, this is fine, this is normal, it's miles from normal.
A few U.S. cities reopened thousands of neglected rape cases.
I knew it. You know, and 20 years ago, the police didn't want to listen to me.
And is coding for everyone.
Now we're telling people you have to learn this programming thing too, or else the robots are going to get you.
That's all on this episode of All Things Considered from NPR West. It's All Things Considered from NPR West. I'm Kelly McEvers, in for Arun Rath. It was one of the strongest storms ever recorded at landfall. Typhoon Haiyan clocked at 147 miles an hour when it struck the Philippines late last year. More than 6,000 people were killed, nearly 2,000 more are missing, and millions were displaced when their homes were destroyed or washed away. And still, authorities are struggling with the simplest tasks, like clearing away debris, rebuilding houses, and counting the dead. I just got back from the Philippine city of Tacloban, a city that bore the brunt of the typhoon. I landed at an airport that has no walls, no control tower. It was clear it's a place with a lot of work to do. And that's our cover story today. Tacloban, 2 months after the storm. I started my tour of Tacloban with Aurora Almendral, a reporter who was there right after the storm and who keeps coming back.
So we just landed in Tacloban. It's pouring rain. The skies are gray and everything is soaking wet. And we're driving down like the main drag, right?
Yeah, this is the main airport route.
And you were here like the fourth day after the storm. You were here really early.
Yeah.
How is it different?
Well, this main road was completely blocked by debris, as in you couldn't drive down it. And we had to walk. We had to walk through debris. We had to walk through neighborhoods. We had to climb like 10-foot high piles of people's former houses.
So now the roads are clear. We're in a car, we're going down. But what struck you when you got here yesterday?
There's been a lot of cleanup, but what also struck me is that it's not finished. It's like far from finished.
Hardly any single structure of the structures that remain has a roof.
I mean, it's about 100 times better, probably. But nothing is fixed. So it's been cleared, but nothing has been repaired for the most part.
Like, there's no electricity.
There's a little bit of electricity, but this area, no.
So it's a sense that there's still, like, a long way to go.
For sure. I mean, there's no way to look at this and think, yeah, this is fine, this is normal. It's miles from normal.
We keep driving into the city. Getting closer to downtown, we start seeing people in the streets.
Shops are open. There's food. People are selling lumber. Obviously, there's fuel. Our price is really inflated.
The food is quite expensive. It's just slightly less than double the price for something, which is huge, especially if you're making zero money because you don't have a job.
You're operating a quote-unquote shop out of like a pile of garbage.
Make a little table and gather some stuff and sell it.
Stall selling instant coffee, limes, boiled eggs.
Beyond downtown, we come to another hard-hit area. This is where massive ships crashed onto shore and destroyed entire neighborhoods.
So, yeah, I mean, these are already areas where people's houses were sort of built in a pretty haphazard way. But it looks like people are rebuilding their stilt houses, like lots of them, exactly where they were before.
Anything you see standing has been rebuilt. This entire area was completely flattened.
So, I mean, the next typhoon and all these...
I mean, unless there's another option, we know exactly where the typhoon is going to pass. And that's the bay. You know, the ships were there for a reason.
What'll happen?
So if there's any more ships that come when another typhoon comes, it's going to be like the same sort of like running over thing.
The same running over thing if authorities don't provide housing. The Philippine government is building temporary dorms called bunkhouses, where each family lives in one small room. But critics say the bunkhouses aren't strong enough to withstand the next storm. And they say with 4 million people displaced, a few thousand bunkhouses aren't nearly enough. Arjun John is with the UN High Commissioner for Refugees. He says the era of big storms is upon us, and officials, international organizations, and communities need to do better at responding.
These storms are not just freak storms. They are probably going to hit many coastlines all over the world, and they are probably just going to get stronger over the next few years and over the next few decades, and we just have to be better prepared to deal with that. We all need to have better contingency plans. We all need to have faster recovery plans. And I think both the Philippines and other countries by the coastlines have to be prepared for this much better.
One thing Tacloban was not prepared for was how to deal with so many casualties. So let's back up for a minute to November 8th, 2013. Typhoon Haiyan is about to make landfall in Tacloban. A guy named Bubi Arce and his friend decide to hide out in a two-story apartment.
Communication cut off, TV gone, electricity gone, everything gone, and the roof flew away.
Water filled the first floor, so they went to the second floor.
And I said, do you know how to climb the wall? I said, why? If we don't do that, we're going to die.
They climbed. The water went up, then went down. By the time they got outside, entire neighborhoods were missing. Cars, furniture, fish floated by. Under a bridge, Bubi and his friend saw the first dead body.
They said, nah, it's an isolated case. I don't think so. My friend said, why?
Because if a body ended up that far inland, Bubi said,
there's going to be a lot of dead people.
Bubi's friend went to find his family. Bubi went to City Hall. He found a working truck and a couple more friends. That's when he decided he had to start picking up bodies.
First five in the first run, then seven, then 15, then 20.
And that was just the first day.
So that's why did you do it? I mean, what, you just thought this needs to be done?
I know, but nobody would do it.
At first, Bubi and his team just put the bodies in a big pit, a mass grave in an existing cemetery. Then the government showed up, an alphabet soup of federal agencies, each with its own idea about what to do. Aid workers say the effort was pretty badly managed. Now, more than 2 months after the storm, Bubi has been appointed the head of Task Force Cadaver in Tacloban, which means even though he's never done this before, Bubi is the guy in charge of collecting, burying, and identifying bodies in the city. Like 2,500 bodies. That's about a third of the total dead in the whole region. And while things are getting better, there are still a lot of challenges. First, what to do with the bodies? Many people in Tacloban agreed an open mass grave was no good. So just a few weeks ago, it was finally covered over with dirt. Now authorities from the Philippine equivalent of the FBI are digging up these bodies, cataloging them, and burying them separately until they can be ID'd. Then there's the issue of how to make those IDs. If someone wants to match a body with a missing loved one, how do they do that? Turns out they have to look in a stack of handwritten notebooks at a local branch of the Philippine National Police. Problem is, their office was blown away by the storm. So the notebooks are kept under tarps inside this rain-soaked tent. Commander Ramos Bergoño shows me the notebooks.
So this is like...
This is the case number.
Case number, okay.
Yes. Or
time and date of the recovery.
The place.
Height, approximate age.
Yes. This is the description.
Wearing a
black sandal.
Leopard print.
Yes.
Shorts. And the gender.
So far, there have been only a few hundred bodies identified. Thousands are still unknown. Officials are taking some DNA samples, but they say there's not enough money to test them. Which brings us to another problem. What to do if IDs are never made? Siobhan Riddell with the World Health Organization is in Tacloban to help Bubi and his team. Standing in the rain at a temporary cemetery, she says the ultimate goal is a monument to those who died in the storm.
We have to know now there will be some that won't be able to be identified, and that will be important for the community and individuals to understand that they can come to a particular space, a particular monument, and grieve knowing that it represents the loss of that person as well.
And now for yet another problem. Bodies are still being found every day, as we see at the cemetery.
So it's a body bag, and there's some tagging information on it. It's got a date. It's been assigned a number.
That's all the retrieval data.
Siobhan is trying to get funding to bring in a team of dogs that are trained to scan the massive piles of debris and find the remaining bodies.
She says that way, people won't think their dead relatives are still out there. Siobhan and Booby say there's a lot more to do, but they say they hope their failures and successes will be a lesson for cities and villages hit by the next Pacific storm. But for the people still looking for their relatives, it isn't much comfort.
So now we're kind of walking into a tent city. It's mostly mud. Climbing in here into a tent. What's her name?
Lorena.
Lorena?
Lorena Sabusap.
Lorena Sabusap now lives in this tent. During the storm, she and several of her 9 kids sheltered in a sports stadium. After the storm, when she came back to her neighborhood, she saw that her house, everything, had simply washed away. Her sister, her niece, and her brother-in-law were just gone. The family searched for 3 weeks for their bodies. We ask if they reported it to the police in the tent with the notebooks.
Kasi kahit na pumunta kami roon, wala naman silang magagawa, wala nga silang tulong sa amin ngayon eh.
She says, no, we didn't go to report it because it's not like they could have done anything. They're not doing anything to help us now. And then I asked her, like, how did you know that they aren't alive anymore? And she said, well, my niece that died, she showed her soul. Like, her other niece saw a child in white that was, like, wet and crouched over. So they knew that that was the ghost of the niece that died.
As for Lorena's own sister, the mother of the girl, Lorena says she heard she survived and made it to shore in the next city over.
Does she believe that?
Opo.
Yeah, she believes it.
She believes her sister is alive. Disaster counselors say this is what you do when you don't get closure. You tell yourself a story that's easier to believe than the thing that might actually have happened. The best thing, they say, is to embrace the ambiguity. Maybe she did wash up on shore with amnesia. Maybe she didn't. That, not a positive ID verified by some government agency, is how Lorena's family might get through the grief. This is NPR News. These days, it seems like Democrats and Republicans have very different visions of the future. But it turns out they can agree on one thing.
Computers are going to be a big part of your future.
Becoming literate in code is as essential to being literate in language and math. It is the only way for you to prepare for the future.
That was President Obama and House Majority Leader Eric Cantor. Soon, they say, everything will be run by machines. And Cantor has a message for how to function in that new world.
Coding is the necessary tool of this century.
It's an interesting idea, but how true is it? It's a warm Saturday night in downtown Santa Monica, California, just a couple of blocks from the beach. Streets are packed with tourists and shoppers. Look through a window on 2nd Street, though. You see 40 or so young people crowded around little square tables. They've got laptops and cords and notebooks splayed out everywhere. Their plan is to spend the night coding.
Instead of go and party for the weekend, stay up for 24 hours and build something cool.
This is Scott Mott. He works for a tech company that builds email servers. And he teaches people to code.
I'm actually a developer evangelist is my official role.
The event is called Code Day. A group called Student R&D throws these all over the country, 24-hour code-a-thons for programmers of all backgrounds and skill levels. The deal is you show up at noon on Saturday, pitch ideas, form teams, code through the night, and finish by noon on Sunday. At this Code Day, there are about a dozen teams. Most projects, like Rachel Feng's, sound pretty straightforward.
A site that you can, like, upload videos and then watch them simultaneously with friends over the internet.
Across the room, Edward Fuchs and Jack Wong are working on something a little more unusual. It's an app you use at night.
It's called a Snore app. We want to make sure that everybody who snores or talks at night never misses that again.
So you turn it on when you go to sleep, and then it'll listen, and then when it hears people making noise, like, it'll record that, so then in the morning you can wake up and listen to your snoring or, like, any sleep talking that you do.
Edward Fuchs and Jack Wong have 5 screens set up between them. 2 laptops, 2 phones, a tablet. They decided to code their Snore app on the bus on the way to the event. Whether they finish by noon on Sunday doesn't really matter, they say.
What does matter is the project will be on their resumes.
I'm hoping to work for Google, or maybe Microsoft, but Google would be like my like dream job.
Everyone here is thinking about jobs, but no one is too worried about it. They all know how to program. Edward Fuchs says programming isn't some kind of secret language anymore.
You don't need to be genius today. Maybe 30 years ago I had to, but today not. Just look at me.
Jacob Scharf is a junior at UCLA. He's working on a video upload site. To him, learning to code is just the way of the future.
It'll be something that everyone knows. Just like everyone knows how to read or write, it'll be something that's taught in middle school or elementary school, and so everyone will be familiar with the basics of it.
Jacob Scharf is not the only person with this idea. Back when he was mayor of New York, Michael Bloomberg tweeted that his New Year's resolution would be to learn code. And just last month, this is how President Obama announced Computer Science Education Week on YouTube.
Don't just buy a new video game. Make one. Don't just download the latest app. Help design it. Don't just play on your phone. Program it.
It's not just the White House that's encouraging people to code. U.S. Representative Tony Cardenas from Southern California has introduced a bill with a name I won't even try to say. It's a string of 34 letters and numbers that spells out in hexadecimal the words America can code. Cardenas is hoping to classify computer programming as a foreign language and allocate grants for schools to start teaching coding as early as kindergarten. But some people are starting to push back.
Reading and writing are hard. The basics are hard. And now we're telling people you have to learn this programming thing too, or else the robots are going to get you.
This is Jeff Atwood. When he was a 12-year-old in the 80s, he was making his own video games. Now he runs a coding blog and a set of websites to help people with programming. That said, he does not think everyone needs to learn how to code.
You know, when I got my first computer in the mid-80s, when you turned it on, what you got was a giant blinking cursor on the screen. That was the boot up. It wasn't like turning on an iPad where you have a screen full of apps and you start doing things. No, you had to figure out what that cursor meant and when the magic incantations to type at that cursor to make programs actually run. And that's the way computers worked back then. And when I hear everyone must learn to program, what I hear is we're going back in time to a place where, you know, you have to be a programmer to do things on the computer.
Right. Somebody's figured it out now, how to not have to do that, is what you're
saying.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think in some sense that's going backwards. I always love the idea that, say, you're, you know, I don't know, a tax prep person, that you don't actually need to learn programming to do your job. Like some programmer figured that out for you.
And what you're saying is there's just only so many people who need to be doing that, not everybody.
Well, it's like sort of like an obsession with being an auto mechanic. I mean, there's tons of cars, there's tons of driving, and it's obviously essential to a lot of what we do as a country. But I think it's a little crazy to go around saying, you know, everybody should really learn to be an auto mechanic because cars are so essential to the functioning of our society. Should you know how to change your oil? Absolutely. There's some basic things that I think you should know when you use a computer. But this whole become an auto mechanic thing, it's just really not for everyone.
So maybe we don't all need to be coders. But Atwood says it's much easier now to figure out if programming is something you do like. He points to tutorial websites that recreate that 1985 experience, complete with blank page and blinking cursor.
And now you got to figure out what to do, and the page sort of walks you through. And you see if you like commanding the machine.
That's the best thing to come out of all this, Atwood says. If you do want to code and you're really serious about it, the resources are there for you to do it on your own. It's All Things Considered from NPR West. I'm Kelly McEvers. Neil Ross studies Antarctica. Not long ago, he found something amazing under the ice.
We discovered a huge valley underneath the West Antarctic ice sheet, which was over 300 kilometres long, more than 2 kilometres below sea level, with a relief of something in the order of about 3,000 metres, so deeper than the Grand Canyon.
The crazy thing about this story is Ross found the valley by accident. He was on a routine research trip to Antarctica, measuring the thickness of the ice. Back at home, he was checking his data when it started to become clear. This massive valley had been under his feet the whole time.
That was a really exciting moment, and it took me a while to convince myself that what I was seeing was actually true.
Ross says the valley was carved by glaciers millions of years ago. Now it provides a record of how the Antarctic ice sheet behaved in the past, when the climate was actually warmer. So studying the valley could help us know how the ice will change as the climate warms again.
We're seeing that the ice sheets are changing in certain parts, particularly around the coastal fringes. And West Antarctica alone could change global sea levels by 3 metres. What we need to do is to understand how these systems might have behaved in the past. So it's a window into the past, but it also gives us a clue as to what might happen in the future.
Of course, Ross says ancient ice can't predict the future, but he says one thing is certain.
Some of the changes that we're seeing to our climate system and to our environment are amplified in the polar regions. And as a result, there has to be a real focus on these areas. And to some extent, that's happening. And that's why we're making these discoveries. We're getting people out there to make the measurements and to observe these situations and these environments. And we're learning more and more.
That's Antarctic researcher Neil Ross. He's the lead author of a paper on the discovery of the valley, published this month in the Geological Society of America Bulletin. It's All Things Considered from NPR West. I'm Kelly McEvers. Back in 2009, two newspaper reporters discovered that police in Cleveland had a massive backlog going back decades of so-called rape kits. These are the DNA swabs that are taken from women who've been raped, DNA that could identify the men who committed the crime. But in thousands of cases, the DNA simply wasn't tested. The kits sat on the shelf. The cases went unsolved. And the rapists went unpunished. Now the kits are being taken down one by one and tested, not just in Cleveland, but in cities like Detroit and Houston, with some amazing results. Rachel DeSell and Layla Atassi of the Cleveland Plain Dealer newspaper are the reason we know about this story. I asked Rachel DeSell how they first heard about the rape kits.
We had been doing some reporting after a serial murder case here in Cleveland where 11 women were raped and killed. And in our reporting that followed that, we started asking a lot of questions about how sexual assault cases were handled. And one of the questions that we asked were about these exams that were done on women and the evidence that was collected and what was done with it. And we couldn't really get a clear answer from Cleveland police. You know, it was basically, I don't know. To their credit, they really decided to find out, and they started a project to count them all, and they had to sort through thousands of kits and other pieces of evidence in their evidence room. What they found was that there was about 4,000 that had never been tested.
Why hadn't they tested 4,000 rape kits?
DNA testing became more widely available in the early 90s. But that doesn't mean that every state or every police department had a method for getting that testing done. It was quite expensive in the beginning. And so the investigations themselves really were not all that extensive.
These untested kits, some of them are very old, you know, 20 years old, some of these cases. How is it that investigators are still able to test them?
So long as they're kept in a cool, dry place, that DNA can be usable for quite a long time. You know, older DNA degrades a little bit, but the DNA tests that they have now are absolutely fabulous when it comes to taking a very small amount of DNA and being able to get a profile. And they've gotten quite a bit of results.
So tell us about those results. I mean, how many prosecutions have they gotten so far?
From around the state, what they're finding with the thousands of kits that have been submitted, about a third of them get something called a hit or a DNA match. And so far, with a little over 1,000 kits tested from Cleveland, it's resulted in close to 80 indictments. And it was well over 20% of these cases that once they went back and got tested, we found out that the suspect wasn't just indicated in one rape, but in multiple rapes.
Cleveland is just one example of these backlog cases, thousands of cases. Like you said, this is happening in other cities. How many, in your estimation, of these untested rape kits are there across America?
The best estimate that I've seen that's used at this point by the federal government is about 400,000. And it's different all across the board. You know, in Houston, they had, you know, more than 8,000. In Detroit, they had 11,000. So we're looking at the big cities, but it's really hard to get a count in all the small areas and the rural areas of what they actually kept, what they threw away, and what they might send in.
Reporter Rachel DeSell, she and her colleague broke this story at the Cleveland Plain Dealer. As the cases get solved, Rachel and her colleague, as well as prosecutors and detectives, are finding themselves in the difficult position of knocking on the doors of rape victims and asking them to talk about horrific things. One of these women is Alyssa Allison. She was raped back in 1993, but her kit was never tested. She says she even told police she knew who her rapist was. Even though he was hiding his face, she was sure it was her landlord.
I had a gut feeling. Everything was pointing that way because he just knew too much about the things that were wrong with my apartment.
Like the broken window in the bathroom the rapist used to break in.
Because I had told him numerous times that that needed to be fixed, and he never fixed it.
Fast forward 20 years to this past summer, and Alyssa gets a knock on the door from a female detective.
I wasn't very nice, to be honest. She's like, I really have to talk to you. And I was like, I'm not ready to talk. I don't know what are you here for? And she's like, well, this is important.
The detective eventually left, but later called Alyssa on the phone.
Well, I'm calling in regards to you being a victim in 1993. And then I had said, were you talking about my rape? And she had said yes. And literally my jaw did drop, literally. I mean, my mouth got really wide open, and it was very surreal because I kind of knew where the conversation was going to go. I said, well, did you find him? And she's like, no, but we do have something called a possible hit, a DNA hit.
That means police had finally tested Alyssa's rape kit and matched the DNA of her rapist to the DNA of the son of the landlord. It was a positive ID.
I think I had said over the phone to her, I knew it. I knew it. You know, and 20 years ago, the police didn't want to listen to me.
It turns out the landlord had raped again, including a woman who lived in Alyssa's building complex. That news was not easy for Alyssa to hear.
And that's the part that really kind of gets me sick. Literally makes me nauseous is the fact that he got away with doing this after he had did this to me. I mean, so far, I think we've got 3 other victims. I don't like that word. I'm going to say survivors. But who knows? There might be others. And that's the part that really gets to me. That breaks my heart.
It was too late to prosecute the landlord. He died in 2005. Alyssa had been keeping a picture of him from his obituary in the newspaper.
So once the case was solved, what did you do with that picture?
I punched it. Really hard. Like, many times. With my fist. I think, like I said, the part that gets to me most was that he had did this to other people. I just literally punched the hell out of the paper. So that's what I did.
Is there any solace right now for you?
It's closure. I just wish that I would have been taken seriously 20 years ago.
Alyssa Allison told us there is one thing that gives her solace, knowing she doesn't have to be afraid of that landlord anymore. It's All Things Considered from NPR West. I'm Kelly McEvers. Isabel Allende is known for her wildly popular novels, full of strong women and magical realism. But her new book, Ripper, is different. It's a grisly murder mystery about a brilliant young girl on the path of a serial killer. The regular host of this program, Arun Roth, sat down with Isabel Allende last week. She began by describing her main character, Amanda, inspired by her own granddaughter.
A nerd with a hood. Beautiful without knowing that she was beautiful, and playing games online. And one of the games she would play was Ripper. And this is a role-playing game in which the players create a character or an avatar that has weaknesses, flaws, and skills. So with those skills and limitations, they play the game. And their whole idea is to catch Jack the Ripper in London, 1888. So I just moved the action to San Francisco 2012 for the kids to find the real murderer in real crimes.
It's interesting you mentioned your granddaughter because it's a very kind of young world of online sleuths and people cracking codes and that kind of thing.
Well, I'm surrounded by young people. You know, I'm always now the oldest and the shortest person in the room. There's nothing good about it. I carry around a little stool to stand on when people want a picture with their cellular phones.
But it must give you a certain perspective, though, right?
Yeah, a very low perspective.
So this book, a thriller, is not something that we really would associate with Isabel Allende, and it opens with a kind of a compelling cliffhanger. What led you to a thriller?
It wasn't my idea. In 2011, I announced that I was going to retire, and my agent panicked. So she said, no, you have to write a book with your husband. My husband is a writer of crime novels.
Right.
His name is William Gordon. And so I had to accommodate to his style because that's what he writes. So we decided we'd give it a try. Well, we almost divorced. We ended up fighting like dogs because he has an attention span of, let's say, 11 minutes, and he writes in English. I can write for 11 hours, and I write in Spanish. I research, he invents. So we ended up fighting because I was sure that I would end up writing the book while he would get half the credit. Not a good deal for me.
How did you strike the balance between research and imagination and your warring approaches?
I research and I study. I went to a mystery writers conference at Book Passage here in Marin County where I live. And I learned a lot from not only from the faculty. And in the faculty, we had forensic doctors, detectives, policemen, experts in guns, etc. But from the questions of the students, for example, if I inject my victim with a blood thinner and I stab the victim 13 times and then I hang the victim upside down in the shower, would the blood congeal in the bathtub? I would never come up with that kind of question or that kind of situation.
Yeah, it's not something that I've spent a lot of time thinking about myself.
But if you ask me now I'm an expert. I can kill anybody and not be caught.
Were there any, the conventions of this form that you found especially difficult to adapt to or anything that you just had to rework to fit yourself?
Well, the book is tongue-in-cheek. It's very ironic. And I'm not a fan of mysteries. So to prepare for this experience of writing a mystery, I started reading the most successful ones in the market in 2012. And that was the Scandinavians, Stieg Larsson and Joe Nesbø and that kind of people. And I realized that I cannot write that kind of book. It's too gruesome, too violent, too dark. There's no redemption there. And the characters are just awful. Bad people, very entertaining, but really bad people. So I thought I will take the genre, write a mystery that is faithful to the formula and to what the readers expect, but it is a joke. It's tongue-in-cheek. My sleuth will not be this handsome detective or journalist or policeman or whatever. It will be a young 16-year-old nerd. My female protagonist will not be this promiscuous, beautiful, dark-haired, thin lady. It will be a plump, blonde healer, and so forth.
The book is set in San Francisco, and it's in ways it's a very loving portrait of the city. And this is the city that you've chosen now to make your home. Can you talk about?
Look, 26 years ago, I was passing by on a book tour. Without any hope of ever staying in San Francisco. But I met a guy, very exotic to me. He was blonde with blue eyes. And I just had a fling that turned out to be love. I moved to San Francisco to spend a week with him and get him out of my system. I'm still here, 26 years later. Now I'm stuck with a husband.
And with San Francisco.
Yeah, but San Francisco is wonderful.
So this book, you could really see this becoming a movie. Are we going to see this thriller, Ripper, become a movie?
Look, my dear, let's not talk about Hollywood.
Okay.
They want everything.
I'm right next to Hollywood. I have to ask.
Well, I'm not willing to sign a contract. They want everything. They want the rights to do the movie and everything else they can think of. Forever. There's no limit to the contract. In this universe and universes to be discovered, I'm not making this up. This is in the contract. And they also want the copyright of the characters. So I lose my characters, and if I want to repeat them in another book, I have to pay them a royalty. Give me a break.
Okay, you hear that, Hollywood? Isabel Allende is looking for some reasonable producers. Isabel, it's been wonderful speaking with you.
Thank you very much.
That was the regular host of this program, Arun Roth, speaking with Isabel Allende about her new thriller, Ripper. You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR West. I'm Kelly McEvers. Shango! That's the voice of Angélique Kidjo, the Grammy Award-winning artist from Benin. Her voice is larger than life, and so is her personality. When she came here to NPR West, she filled our hallways with her big laugh. She says she's been like that since she was a little girl.
I mean, from the moment I wake up in the morning, I'll be running so much. My mom is like, can you calm down for a moment? I'm like, what for? Do you have something for me? No, not yet. Boom, I'm already gone. She's just like, oh my God.
At 53 years old, Angélique is still moving at the speed of light. Her 11th studio album, Eve, is out on Tuesday. On it, she collaborates with some big names, the Luxembourg Philharmonic Orchestra, Kronos Quartet, Dr. John. She also showcases the voices of African women. Her first song, Mbumba, features women she met on a trip to Kenya as a UNICEF Goodwill Ambassador.
I arrived in the second village, and as I was walking in, I have those women standing with their beautiful gown. The voice come from out of this world. My heart start tingling, my shiver everywhere, and I was just like... And then I joined the singing without even thinking. It was just those situations where you feel like you're in another world. And while I was experiencing that, my husband was smart enough to see me reacting to it, took the iPhone and filmed me singing with the lady. Only God knows what they're saying. I don't speak that language. I don't understand the language. I just jump in. And after that, then I had a vision, because the song that I've been writing before was already about women issues. So I'm like, this is it. I want the world to hear this beautiful voice and feel the same shiver that I felt.
You know, you say that you've done a lot of talking about African women. I mean, you're like you said, you're a UNICEF Goodwill Ambassador. But with this album, you say you wanted to let the women kind of speak for themselves. How did that work? How did you go out and make these field recordings with women in your home country, Benin? What did you say to them?
I mean, the first experience I have of the field recording was in 1985, where I just assumed that because I grew up in the city, there's going to be electricity outlet everywhere. So I learned hardly, and I had to plug all my equipment on the battery of the car. So this time around, I went there with a boombox and a recorder, a digital recorder. So I brought a lot of batteries to be covered. I mean, I can open a store of battery right now as we speak. So I went first to Porto Novo. There I met two groups of women. And when I started playing the music, the reaction for every single women group was the look they gave me. Like, you kidding us?
So you were playing them songs, your own songs.
My song. And they look at me and I say, okay, don't panic. I'll do it with you. Because they were so eager to give me songs to be with me that they didn't want to mess it up. So I'll start singing with them, and then step by step, the music call, you cannot just stay without reacting to it. They start singing and singing and singing.
So all you had to do is play just a little bit of your own music.
And that's
and
it.
And turn it off, and then they would just
they just go.
Wow. You have won a Grammy. You received classical training in Paris. I think people might be surprised to hear that you don't read music.
Yeah, I don't.
How do you pull that off?
You know, I have a very great memory. I mean, when I was in the jazz school, I was going to a class of reading music. And after 3 months, the teacher told me, He called me aside and said, come here. See, I saw you. You memorize everything. You know the whole book by heart. If you stay here, you're going to kill your memory. And that gonna be hard for you. Get out of here. I'm like, it was so boring class for me. I'm like, why am I gonna do me bad? I'm like, what the hell is this? Like, this is just that doesn't fit in my life. And when he said that, I said, God bless you, hooray! I'm out of here. Yee-hee! I ran fast. I'm like, I'm never going to come back. I was so glad I'm not doing it.
I'm speaking with Angélique Kidjou. Her new album is called Eve. And in addition to the new album, you've also released a memoir earlier this month. It's called Spirit Rising. You go back to your childhood in the West African country of Benin and to your first time performing on stage. Can you tell us about that?
Oh, wow. That was the freaking experience ever. That's the first time I experienced the expression, all your bone is shaking in your body and you can hear it going, but I'm like, hey, this is kind of cool. I have the light in front of me. I can hardly see anyone in the public. It was all dark back there. There were only one spotlight in the whole theater, and it was on me. So I'm like, nobody's seeing me. I can goof around. I can sing my song and get the hell out of here.
What was the song you sang? Thank you.
You're welcome.
It's great. How old were you when you sang it?
Six.
Six. Your book talks about, too, how you started as this really naive girl in the beginning. You know, you were from a family of musicians, but you were from a small village. And now you're this huge public figure on the world stage, you know, sort of representing your continent. How did you make that? How did that transition happen?
There have been two moments in my life. That the first one, I didn't even know the impact it has before the second one arrived. When I first saw the cover of Jimi Hendrix on an album with his big afro, and my brother was trying to wear the afro wig too. He said, I want to look like him. I want to play like him and sound like him. I said, by the way, I wanted to ask you, what is this language he's singing? I understand nothing. Is he look African, but it's not an African language I can recognize. He said, no, he's not African. He's African-American. I look at him, I'm like, you're right. I'm 9 and I'm stupid, you think. How can you be African and American at the same time? He said he's a slave descendant. I said, what is a slave? What is a descendant? What's going on here? So I went to ask my grandmother. She started telling me the story of slavery. I'm like, you're losing your mind. I didn't believe it. And then when I turned 15, for the first time I heard about apartheid. When I saw Winnie Mandela on the Nigerian TV that we smuggled into.
Apartheid.
Apartheid. It's just like your whole world collapsed because you live in a family, in a household where you're taught by your parents that a human being is not a matter of color because we all one human family. And then suddenly both of them, my 9 years old story and the apartheid story just collided. It's just like explosion in my life. And I get so angry. And I went into my room and wrote for the first time what we can call today Engage, a political song. In the album Aye, where the song is called Azanakwe, which means the day will come. The first draft of that song was so hateful I can't even start to remember it. When I start singing it, my father said to me, no, it's not going to happen here. Not under this roof. I told you violence and hate will not have any space in this house. Music has always been the last resource for me to deep down in myself, beyond anger, beyond pain, to find that place that is always there of light, peace, and love to bring it out. Because if you let hate and violence into your heart and into your soul, there's no way you come back out of that.
How do you, as an artist, you know, counter all the negative images we see out of Africa? Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, on one hand, you're supposed to be this, you know, international spokesperson about the challenges that some Africans face. But then on the other hand, your music is about victory and joy and music and dance. Does that kind of mean you're pulled in two different directions sometimes?
The negative image of Africa is a story that has been told by other people. We Africans have never told our stories. And the present today with the technology is showing a different story, a different vision from Africa. For me as an African, I feel comfortable in my body enough and in the culture that I hold because my culture have impacted and inspired all the music of the world. Whatever is out there, you take back, you find Africa in it. You can bring more to your own culture by being open. I've always been open to every different culture. That's what makes me rich. That's what makes me the artist that I am, because I don't I really don't care. I don't care the skin color you have. I don't care the language you speak. When it comes to music, I am at the service of the song, and we all should be.
That's Anjali Kijo. Her new album is called Eve. That comes out on Tuesday. You can hear the full album at nprmusic.org. Her memoir is Spirit Rising. That's out now. Here at All Things Considered, we've been collecting stories of triumph, big and small, those moments when people make great leaps forward in their careers. We call it My Big Break. And for our next guest, the hard part wasn't the audition. It was waiting for a call from the big boss, Lorne Michaels, the executive producer of Saturday Night Live.
My name is Bobby Moynihan, and I am a cast member on Saturday Night Live. For many years, I was working all day as a bartender at a Pizzeria Uno, then going doing improv at night, and then doing it all again the next day. I kind of just spent 10 years just doing improv and kind of got on SNL's radar. They asked me to come audition, and I was absolutely terrified, but elated because that's all I've ever wanted to do. It's like the equivalent of like, hey, you're going to go to space. It's like, yeah, that's a great idea. I would love to go to space, but it's really dangerous and terrifying up there. They put you in a dressing room, and then you sit there for 4 hours, panicking that your life is about to change in 10 minutes. They finally brought me into the studio, and you see that stage, and you're like, oh my God, I'm here. I think for my impressions, I did Nathan Lane. I did the dumbest bit in the world. I did Nathan Lane for the Hamburger Society, and I believe the only thing I said was, something familiar, something peculiar, something for everyone. Eat a hamburger tonight. I did somebody that was based off of somebody I worked with at Pizzeria Uno, a character named Mark Payne, who constantly thought everything smelled like pepper. He just walked around. He said, "What? Do you smell that? It smells like pepper up in here. It smells like there's a pepper tornado, like we in the movie Twister. Someone call Helen Hunt and Bill Paxton and tell them that we got a Class 5 pepper twister on our hands." Lots of that. I auditioned, and then I got called in to meet with Lorne relatively soon after, maybe the next day. Waited on his couch for about, I think that one was 9 hours. Talked to Lorne for about 40 minutes, and then he said very fleetingly, you know, I think we'll start you in January and, you know, we'll figure it out. And I didn't know what that meant. I didn't know if I had gotten the show or not. And then the writer's strike happened. So I spent, I think, 9 months or whatever, however long it was, just sitting in my apartment waiting. And then the writer's strike ended. And I got a phone call from SNL, and I was like, this is it. They're going to tell me to come to work on Monday. And they told me that Maya Rudolph had had a baby during the break, so they had to hire a woman instead. And I was devastated. Yeah, that was the worst ever. I ended up getting lucky and doing a couple movies, and then I got a phone call from Seth Myers. Seth said, why don't you come back in and audition? We're having auditions this week. And when it was over, I was just more relieved because it had been like a 14-month process. I went out that night. I'm not a big drinker. I polished off a bottle of wine. And I woke up at 1 o'clock in the afternoon to my phone ringing with a very bad headache. And it was Lorne. All I remember was the very last thing he said was, so I think, I think America will like you on the show, and we'll see you next week. And then I said, thank you so much, you made my day. And he said, well, I hope it lasts longer than that. And, great, well, you sound tired, I'll let you go. And I thought I lost the job at that moment. And, and then I hung up the phone and had no idea what had happened. I wasn't sure if I had really gotten it. I didn't know what was happening, but then I got a text from Seth a couple minutes later saying congratulations, and that was it. I had moved back home at that point for a little while, and my mother works at the town hall across the street from my apartment, and I ran across the street in boxers and a t-shirt. Didn't even think to put pants on, and ran across the street to my mom hysterically crying and told her that my life's dream had come true, and sat on a bench and smoked about 70 cigarettes. My big break was spent in my underwear smoking cigarettes, yes.
Bobby Moynihan is still a cast member on Saturday Night Live. You can also catch him on the new FX series, Chosen. And we want to hear about your big break. Send an email with your story to mybigbreak@npr.org. Once again, you're listening to All Things Considered from NPR West. I'm Kelly McEvers.
If I had ever been in before, I would probably know just what to do.
Don't you?
In the history of rock and roll, few people have had the vantage point of David Crosby. He was a founding member of the Byrds and Crosby, Stills, and Nash, and sometimes Young. He performed at Woodstock. He worked with Jackson Browne, Jefferson Airplane, Joni Mitchell, James Taylor, Carole King. He is the consummate collaborator. And yet, in all that time, David Crosby has released only 3 solo albums. That is, until Tuesday, when he shares his first in more than 20 years. It's called Cros.
Looking out on the buzzing city, molecules go flying by. Standing here in the very lost disciple, how could it be that angel flies?
David Crosby's last solo record was A Thousand Roads back in 1993. Not long after that, he almost died. A new liver gave him the time he's had since. So when he came by our studios here in Culver City, California, I asked if this David Crosby is different than the man we heard 21 years ago.
Well, considerably. I came very close to dying. I remember when I was watching a biograph piece, and they had interviewed my main doctor. They said, well, how close was it? And he said, he was about a week from dying. And I just rocked back in my chair. Because, of course, they don't tell you that. But that's a pretty close call.
Are there lyrics on this album that you wrote because you've been through an experience like that?
There's certainly an attitude. It affects you, very strongly. You feel like every day that you get, you wake up and you say, oh, my God, they gave me another one. Oh, boy, what can I accomplish today? It makes you really treasure your time. Yes, there's a lyric I can think of. In Time I Have, I talk about not wanting to waste my time being angry.
People do so many things that make me mad. But angry isn't how I want to spend the time I have. Cognitive dissonance, they call it. And I wonder just how small it could be made to be in me.
You've been recording and touring with your son, James Raymond, for several decades now, and he's also a major part of this record. I know you've told the story 1,000 times, but I'm hoping you can tell it again, the story of how you guys came to find each other again.
Yeah, it's kind of a miracle. His mom put him up for adoption when he was born, and it was a good choice. And you can't hunt for him from the parent down, only from the kid up. So when he got married and he was just about to have his first child, his parents had said, you ought to find out who your genetic parents are. So he had found out that his mom lived in Australia, and he'd found out there was an open registration, and he looked at the papers, and there was my name. And he said, nah, couldn't be. And then he found out that it was. And he got a hold of someone who knew me, and he did one of the kindest things I've ever seen another human being do. Now, those kind of meetings usually go badly. Both people arrive with a lot of baggage, the parent usually with a lot of guilt, the kid with a lot of anger. Why did you leave me and Mom? We weren't good enough for you. He came with nothing. He came with no baggage. He gave me a clean slate. He let me earn my way into his life and his heart And that is a very high level of human being.
And James has written a couple of songs on this album, yeah?
Oh, man, he wrote so well on this record that I can't believe it. He's as good as I am or better.
This kind of love don't need a home. This kind of heart beats all alone. This kind of world, gonna let it go. Lay down the things that came before.
My guest is the legendary David Crosby. His new solo album is called Cros. I want to ask you a question that's possibly out of left field. I'm wondering if you saw the Coen Brothers film Inside Llewyn Davis?
Not yet.
Okay. Okay.
I'm going to see it. I'm a little afraid of it.
Oh.
Well, I've been a Coen Brothers fan since Blood Simple. And I know that if they write about singer-songwriters who are not stars, it's going to be real. It's going to affect me very strongly emotionally. I know this movie is going to affect me very strongly because I know it will be truthful and I know there will be pain there. But they do tell you the truth about what it's like to have this drive to put your songs out there and sing, you know, to people.
Why would that be painful for you? Because you put your songs out there and people accepted them and liked them and you are now who you are.
Yeah, but that's now. For a long time, I was a kid in a bar. Broke, before that in a coffee house. My earliest ones, I was passing a basket in a basket house in New York after I sang. And if there wasn't any money in the basket, I didn't have dinner. That was that. It's not easy, and it's gotten harder since then. I'm lucky I got in when I did.
We talked about working with your son James on this album.
Mm-hmm.
And your other son Django took some of the photographs for it.
Yeah, he took the cover.
He's in his 20s now?
He's 18.
He's 18. We heard a line in the song Dangerous Night. I want to believe I can pass happy to my child, but the truth gets lost and the system runs wild.
Yeah, and the two lines before it are, I try to write Buddha and it comes out guns. I vote for peace. And the blood still runs.
So what are these lines about? Is this about what you want, the legacy you want to leave to your kids?
Yes. And I worry a great deal about the world we're handing them. Our government is broken. Our democracy is broken. Other people own our government now. Yes, I am worried.
Send me someone who has doubts about it, who has conquered.
Listening to this new album, Cros, you know, there is a kind of hopefulness there. Maybe a weary hopefulness, but it's there.
Yes.
I know you're worried about the future and what you're going to, the country you're going to leave your kids, but there's got to be some hope there too, huh?
Yes. I have hope because of human beings. I like human beings. It's an attitude thing. If you go down in despair, you can't function and you can't do any good. If you have hope in your heart, you can. It's that simple.
David Crosby, his first solo album in more than 20 years, comes out on Tuesday. It's called Cros. Mr. Crosby, thank you so, so much for being here.
It's such a pleasure, man. I am a huge NPR fan. I listen all the time.
For the week ending January 26, 2014, that's the podcast edition of All Things Considered from NPR West, the best of our programs from Saturday and Sunday. The production staff includes Phil Harrell, Becky Hersher, Tom Dreisbach, Priska Neely, Becky Sullivan, Danny Hajek, Lena Anwar, and Francesca Fenzi. Our intern is Stephen Jackson. Marcia Caldwell is standing in for Patrick Murray as technical director, with technical support from Leo Del Aguila. Muthoni Muturi is senior editor, and Steve Lichtai is our senior producer. I'm Kelly McEvers. We'll be back next week with your regular host, Arun Roth. And remember, you can always hear the show on your local public radio station. Thanks for listening.